It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, incumbent Ron Johnson prevailed in Wisconsin's U.S. Senate race and Speaker of the House Paul Ryan sailed to an easy victory. A political scientist will dig into the results and what they mean for Wisconsin.
First, a number of issues were up in the air coming into Election Day with a long agenda in place for the new Congress and president.
Now that Donald Trump is the president-elect with majorities in the House and Senate, there are questions about likely priorities and policies from Supreme Court appointments to the Affordable Care Act to trade and immigration.
And then there are the intangible questions. Will the new president and Congress be able to work together after rifts within the Republican Party? And will the new leadership be able to build bridges after a contentious election?
Barbara Perry joins us now. She's a professor of ethics and institutions and director of presidential studies at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Barbara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob and Veronica. Good to be with you.
Well, before we get into specific issues, Barbara, let's talk about the divide in this country and what it's going to mean for the new administration. You were quoted in a recent article saying the new president would face maybe the biggest challenge since Abraham Lincoln, 1860, looking at now a virtually ungovernable nation. How so?
Well, we certainly are divided. That's clear from this race and the nature of this campaign. And it's been that way for a number of years. We can go back to Bush v. Gore, for example, that we seem pretty evenly divided, the so-called red and blue states, Democrats, Republicans, liberals, and conservatives. Some divisions along regional lines, some divisions along education and income lines. And so they're all there. I don't want to put too much emphasis on the ungovernable part of it, but what I meant by that is that I'm a huge admirer of our founding fathers and of our Constitution, and I think that they could never have imagined, no matter how much foresight they had, the role that media, social media, the growth of the electorate, the expansion of the electorate would have in our society, and just what that would mean for our constitutional system. So whereas they had in place all of these mechanisms to try to check the will of the people, as a matter of fact, even the only people who could vote in their day, mostly white male property owners, they still worried about what they called the whims and passions of the people. So Madison wrote in Federalist Paper 51 that if men were angels, no government would be necessary. So they were pragmatist, and they knew that men and now women are not angels, and so they tried to check the devilish nature, perhaps, of human nature. And yet they couldn't have anticipated all of these other elements that are now added into our system that on occasion, I think, do make us somewhat ungovernable. But all I have to do is point to government gridlock to indicate that it's hard for government to govern us.
Let's listen to President-elect Donald Trump in his victory speech talking about trying to patch things up.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans, and this is so important to me.
So we saw George W. Bush come in with compassionate conservatism. He called himself a uniter, not a divider. President Obama coming in said he'd try to bridge the partisan divide. Didn't come out well in either case. Donald Trump ran a pretty aggressive campaign. A lot of people for and against him saw it as fairly divisive. Could he change to a more positive tone and heal some of these rifts?
Remains to be seen. That's awfully glib, I know, but it does remain to be seen. I think all of these people do have good intentions. I try never to question the motivations of our leaders. I always hope that they are acting in good faith. I noticed that Secretary Clinton mentioned that in her concession speech. So I'm hoping for the best. And if it doesn't happen that these divides are bridged, it doesn't mean that we have to have gridlock. So, for example, and you mentioned Obama saying he wanted to unite the United States and bring together the red and the blue states and to be United States of America. And yet when he came into office, he held the presidency. It was one party. Democrats held the House and the Senate, and he passed through the Affordable Care Act on completely partisan grounds. But nevertheless, he had said that that was at the top of his list. That was at the top of his agenda. People elected him. People elected Democrats to the House and the Senate, and he passed through perfectly allowable partisan agenda. Now it will be up to the Republicans, who can now move forward if they want to repeal that. People have voted for a Republican in the presidency and a House and Senate that are majoritarian Republicans. So I'm never particularly bothered by that. I may not agree with one party or the other, and so I may not put those things at the top of my agenda, but I'm never bothered by one party winning and becoming the majority and putting at the top of the list what they want to do. I just saw the movie All the Way over the weekend about Lyndon Johnson in his first year in office after the assassination of President Kennedy, you know, passing Kennedy's bill. Kennedy had proposed the Civil Rights Bill, which became the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, and Lyndon Johnson was able to do that in a bipartisan fashion. Those days may be gone, sadly, but let's hope not.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, getting into policy priorities now for the new administration. And let's get into some of those things that the president and Congress will have to deal with. And let's start with Supreme Court. There is an open seat now. It looks like it will not be filled by Merrick Garland. What are you looking at when Congress is back in session and when Donald Trump nominates, I assume, not Merrick Garland?
I think it's pretty safe to say it will not be Merrick Garland, and that's a shame because he was touted by both Democrats and Republicans. He was viewed as a moderate liberal, to be sure, but nevertheless had high marks from both sides of the aisle. And that would be the sort of thing that would have been a way to show bipartisanship in the nation's capital. But I think you're right that nomination now will die as the Congress goes out of session after the lame duck session. And that Donald Trump was very specific, more so than Secretary Clinton, about the types of people he would put on in terms of names. So he gave out two lists over the campaign of about 10 each. So about 20 names that he's put out, I suspect, that were given to him by the Federalist Society, for example. So these were primarily conservative judges and justices in the lower courts of appeals of the United States federal courts and some state Supreme Courts, about half and half division. It's also interesting to note to me that his sister, Marianne Trump Berry, is a federal judge. So he may have more expertise in this area than people want to give him credit for, but I think it's safe to say it'll be a conservative. But then if we think about the seat that was Justice Scalia's, it will be tit for tat. It'll be a conservative replacing a conservative, no doubt. And I suspect now the only thing is, will the Democrats say, hey, you know, we wanted to have Merrick Garland and you Republicans wouldn't even give him a hearing, so we're going to filibuster. And there's not, the Republicans have a majority, but they don't have a filibuster-proof majority. So it's possible that Democrats, if they are not in a conciliatory mood, could go down that road.
Let's bring on Todd now in Appleton. Todd, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, yes. I was just calling about that very thing because I know that we had both Harry Reid and Tim Kaine on the campaign trail that said that they would, if they got control of the Senate, that they would use the nuclear option without hesitation. If they didn't have a 60-vote majority, they'd use the nuclear option to get their Supreme Court nominees appointed. And nobody seemed to be batting an eye about that. Like, oh my gosh, they wouldn't do that. But when the Republicans, it was suggested several years ago, the Democrats, the Republicans suggested that, and Democrats warned them, oh, you better not, that's way over the top and things like that. So now, you know, I'm wondering how the Democrats and the media are going to treat Republicans if they just decide, well, the hell with your filibuster, we're just going to go with the nuclear option.
Todd, thanks for the call. And the nuclear option being a change of Senate rules to basically eliminate, to take the filibuster out of consideration, allow a majority vote to approve, say, a Supreme Court justice, Barbara. What do you think are the prospects for that?
Yeah, it's possible, to be sure, because they implemented that for the lower federal courts. So for appointments to the circuit courts and the district courts, the trial courts in our federal system, so there is no option now for the filibuster for those. So yeah, there is talk about that as a possibility, and we'll just have to see.
Talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking ahead at important policy decisions lying ahead for President-elect Donald Trump and the Republican Congress.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What are your hopes and your fears for policy changes in a Trump administration? Is the Affordable Care Act, do you think, likely to go? And do you see that as good news or bad news? Is there any chance of becoming less divided in the next few years? Call in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us. There's more to come.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we continue our conversation with Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at top policy issues facing the Donald Trump administration and the new Congress.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you hoping changes or doesn't change in health care, immigration, tax reform, trade policy? You name it. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go back to our callers, Barbara, I want to get to a couple more issues you had mentioned. The Affordable Care Act. Donald Trump all along has said repeal this. Republicans have been wanting to repeal and replace it for some time. Do you think it will be, first of all, repealed? And will people come together, the Republicans, on a plan to replace it with something?
I think certainly probably at or near the top of the list for the next president will be an attempt to repeal and perhaps replace that had been in, again, at the near his agenda top for all of this campaign. The question again, will it be able to get through the Senate and not be filibustered to death? We're just going to have to wait and see what kind of mood the Democrats are in, and this would presume unanimity on the part of the Republican Party, which is not necessarily a safe assumption, but I would presume that this would be an issue along with the Supreme Court justice around which most Republicans on the Hill and the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue could come together. Again, though, the sticking point will be the possibility of filibustering all of these things and not even getting them back to the desk of the new president.
Another big issue that could be a point of friction between Donald Trump and some Republicans in Congress is trade policy. A lot of Republicans have supported international trade agreements, kind of a pro-business plank as they see it. Donald Trump obviously ran against current and potential future trade deals. How do you see that issue playing out?
Yeah, I think that's going to be, as you say, that's going to be a different kettle of fish from certainly from the Supreme Court nomination and the Affordable Care Act, that this is one that there is not consensus right now in the Republican Party. So I presume that Trump, if he follows the promises that he made on the campaign trail, will try to go down this road on TPP, for example, and maybe even try to roll back things like NAFTA. Whether he can get a majority of his own party to approve of that remains to be seen. It's going to be fascinating to see if this person who prides himself on being able to do the art of the deal, this is exactly where the art of the deal is required, and that is to get with the pin. This is where somebody like a Lyndon Johnson was just superb at arm twisting and back scratching and all of the things that went into getting people over to his side, no matter what side of the aisle they were on. So we'll see if Donald Trump is able to do that.
Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I just want to say, as a Hillary, as a person who voted for Hillary Clinton, I always looked upon her as a deeply flawed candidate because she did not have an overriding theme or vision for her candidacy. I mean, Donald Trump on the right and Bernie Sanders on the left had a populist message. And I think that's one of the messages or points that the Democratic Party must look at when planning for the future, be it Senator Warren or someone else as a standard bearer, because her entire campaign struck me, or theme was, well, I'm not Donald Trump. And that isn't always a reason for people to vote for you. And I'll hear the your professor's answer off the air. Thank you.
Jim, thanks for the call. And Barbara, what do you think of what Republicans are going to be doing while they are out of power in all chambers of power in Washington?
Yeah, what Democrats are going to be doing as the out party we'll see. It's going to be fascinating. I take Jim's point, and this was a common criticism of Secretary Clinton, that while she was always viewed as the policy wonk and she could get down into the weeds of policy and have all the details, and I thought that she always did fine with that, going back to her days of pushing, unsuccessfully, but pushing for health care reform as First Lady. And so she was able to do that in the debates and on the stump. But Jim is right to say what she was missing was that vision, the so-called vision thing that George H.W. Bush used to mention that he was accused of not having. And I think part of that, too, is that the Clintons themselves, certainly starting with Bill Clinton, remember the third way, that he was the moderate liberal, moderate Democrat. And while he was able to pull that off, I don't think that she was. And I think she was trying to straddle between moderation and trying to bring in the Elizabeth Warren wing of the party and the Bernie Sanders wing of the party. And it ended up feeling diluted rather than having a clear, crisp vision. The question now will be which direction will the party go? Will it now sort of tack back leftward towards the wing of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders?
Thanks for that call, Jim, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Barbara Perry from the University of Virginia, looking at the results of yesterday's election and what it means moving forward, especially in terms of policy for the Republican president and Congress. An announcement, Myron Ebell, who's director of the Center for Energy and Environment with the Conservative Competitive Enterprise Institute, he's going to be the EPA transition leader. This is someone who has not believed in the general scientific consensus of global warming, has opposed anti-global warming message. Is Donald Trump has spoken out against global warming. Is this a pretty strong signal that the United States' approach to climate change and energy is going to change?
It certainly sounds like it. To put someone like that, who is thinking, I guess, as Donald Trump does, that global warming is a hoax and is not scientifically proven, or, there are those who think that global warming is happening, but it's not necessarily caused by human behavior. It is part of a cycle of climate. I thought that science had debunked that, but apparently not to Donald Trump's satisfaction, and it sounds like that's where he's going to go in his environmental policy.
Let's go to another caller now. Steve is with us in Green Bay. Steve, hi.
Hi there. I was actually wanting to have a comment because the big theme for the right in the last 8 years has basically been we don't want to do anything. It was a big message of tear down the Affordable Care Act, stop this, stop that. So now that the ball's in their court, I guess, from a top-down perspective, I guess what's the professor's take on what is going to be put forward? Do we have any idea what the alternative, where the movement is going to go? Because so far it seemed like the only thing being espoused was we just don't want anything to happen. So,
gotcha, Steve. So Republicans moving from the outside party in terms of the White House and obstructionist, they were accused of and sometimes admitted to. They wanted to thwart President Obama's agenda. Well, now they own the place. What is going to be the transition there from opposition to trying to get stuff done?
Yeah, I think that raises such a fascinating question because there was both that kind of mainstream Mitch McConnell Republicanism that was we're fighting to make Barack Obama one-term president, and we just were going to be obstreperous and obstructionist. And yet that also was, I think, the caller's point perhaps about the Tea Party. So remember when the Tea Party comes in as a response to a blowback to the Affordable Care Act in 2010 in the midterms, that they really do seem totally obstructionist, that's all that they care about is obstructionism. So again, this, I think, goes back to the now now the different elements and factions within the Republican Party are there. I don't think that Mitch McConnell exists to be obstructionist, but he did to obstruct Democrats. I think if he has an agenda that he would like to move forward, he'd be fine with that. But I have always wondered, how does one deal with an opposition not on policy but on the very existence of government and what government should do or not do, and the choice would be have it do nothing. And then my question is always, have it do nothing until what? Until a tornado hits your town, a hurricane hits your town, your crops fail because of a terrible climate situation. It's always interesting to me how some people don't want government to do anything until they're immediately impacted by a disaster.
Steve, thanks for the call. Go next to Saeed in Green Bay. Saeed, hi.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to contrast the nominating process of the two parties and how that, I think, eventually controlled the outcome. On the Republican side, the Republican establishment had almost no control over the process. It was very much driven by the organic grassroots activities. The Republicans criticized that and lamented how they ended up with the nominee, which many viewed as imperfect. But it was driven by grassroots. Then you look at the Democratic side and how the DNC very much controlled the process. Superdelegates played a very, very big role. And now we know that actually the DNC was in collusion with the Clinton campaign to eliminate that grassroots candidacy of Bernie Sanders. And I think that, at the end, is the controller of the outcome.
Saeed, interesting point. So, Barbara, a lesson maybe for Democrats is the Republicans, to a greater extent than the Democrats, let primary voters determine the outcome. Democrats didn't. Look who won.
Yeah, this is in a campaign that's been so topsy-turvy, with everything stood on its head and seemingly no common wisdom being either wise or common or applicable. I think this is one of the most fascinating to me as a political scientist, and that is that you have these two parties that, as the caller said, did things oppositely in terms of how they chose their candidate, and the irony is that the Republican establishment thought, oh, we are headed down such a bad road. We will never be able to. We don't want this man, and we'll never be able to elect him. And what do they do now that he's been elected? Do they say, oh, well, you know, never mind. That's okay. You know, our party's in control, so we'll just go with that. And what do the Democrats do? Is this a kind of reverse of what happened after the George McGovern debacle and lost to a landslide in 1972 to Nixon, when superdelegates were placed into the mix by the Democratic Party establishment to make sure that they were picking more moderate, more establishment people?
Always fighting the last war. Barbara Perry, thanks for joining us today. That's Barbara Perry, professor of ethics and institutions at the University of Virginia's Miller Center. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time on the Ideas Network.